Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, hour two, and I'm just communicating with a vet down in Florida, and checking in to see how. I mentioned Claude Ray earlier, and he was sidelined with a strain, and getting him back, and he's been jogging, and I think we got one more evaluation to. Let him start galloping again. And it's good news. Nice. Oh, nice to also welcome in Rich Migliori, the New York Racing Association, and America's Day at the Races. Rich. Oh. Richie, where is he?
Can you hear me?
No, there we go. Can hear you now.
Okay. Good morning. By the way, I came in on the tail end of that. Did you guys name a horse for Shug?
Yes. Yes.
Because that's what Gary calls him all the time.
Exactly. Exactly. Whenever Gary's giving him the business. How you feeling today, Claude Ray?
Oh, that's so funny. I hope this horse can run.
he's a big, huge, an enormous. He's a data link, which is one of the, you know, the other parts of why we were inclined to do something with in Shug's direction. I mean, the funny thing is, when I first put the name in, the jockey club came back and said, "No, you can't use it." So why not? Well, it's a name. I said. So Aaron Yagoda, who actually we bought the horse from Aaron, it was a horse that Aaron pinhooked, and Aaron said, "Just tell him it's not necessarily Claude Ray McGahee the Third. It could be any Claude Ray."
And so your uncle Claude Ray, come on,
exactly. So Aaron, because Aaron's hysterical, he does a like an obituary search, and he finds a bunch of Claude Rays that he said,
that's
send
great.
Them this, tell them you named it after this guy that died in 1937.
That's fantastic. I love it.
So as it happens, we had that fundraiser for Captain. And Shug was the guest of honor, and it was right around the same time. And so I said, Shug, can you do me a favor? Can I write a note saying it's okay for me to name this horse, Claude Ray? He said, sure. He said, I don't mind.
So that's cool. Well, yeah, I Shug's a good sport. He's not going to care about that.
No. Well, I don't know if I ever told you. We've had lots of misadventures trying to name horses, and we put a lot of work into it. And one, you're indirectly involved in Lloyd Dobler, because his first name is what I tried to name him first was Harold Carmichael,
okay.
An Eagle receiver. Well, the dam, his dam, her name was I Aim High.
Okay.
And there was that group of Eagle receivers that were known as the Fire High Gang, led by Harold Carmichael.
You're very clever. That's good. I like that.
Well, but then when I went to do that, they said, well, that's you're naming it after somebody, after a prominent person. You need his permission. So he was at the time, he might still be actually, Harold was working for the Eagles in community relations. So I called the Eagles. They connect me to Harold. And, I mean, it's enough of a thrill that I'm talking to Harold Carmichael. And I said, Harold, can I get your permission to name a horse after you? He said, well, what do I have to do? I said, just give me permission. He says, well, I don't know. He goes, I don't know if I like the sound of this. I said, well, Harold, it's an honor. Yeah. I said, it's an honor. We're trying to do this. He says, you know what? You better talk to my agent and run it by him. And the problem was, it was literally, you know, January 31st, and the next day is the naming deadline. And so I came up with Lloyd Dobler, because it was at the time, it was like the 20th anniversary of Say Anything, and I had seen it somewhere, and so Lloyd Dobler ended up being a fabulous name. People went crazy. They loved that when I named it after the John Cusack character in Say Anything.
Oh, that's great. Good, yeah. Good. That's funny.
Well, so now today's, when I do the listing for the show today, we're going to use the picture of you and Lloyd Dobler.
Okay, good. Oh, yeah, Gary was busting my chops over the weekend, telling somebody, yeah, he came out, he couldn't hardly walk, he was riding my horse with a broken neck, he should have won. Thanks, Gary. Keep making me feel good.
That's great. Well, listen, what else would you expect? He's been giving you the business for, what, 35 years?
Yeah, he should have that, like, as his motto for training, giving people the business for 40 years, right?
Underneath the sign. That's a good idea, actually. Yeah, that's it. Busting chops since 1994.
You know what? We should talk to Roddy about getting him the name of Bustin' Stones for Gary, Bustin' Chops.
Gary was an early believer in Bustin' Stones. He liked them. He liked the Babies when he first saw them. Tribeca, he bought for $10,000.
Tell you what, he could be the best bargain in racing as far as stallions go. Bustin' Stones, they all run. You know, they may, you know, be a little bit cheaper, some of them, but they all run. They'll find their level and they will win.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting things about the regional, you know, about regional stallions anyway. I mean, that they, you know, the ones that throw the switch, you know, and end up, you know, that they end up moving on. I mean, look at Leoban. Leoban, you know, he's the latest. He's just the most recent example.
Yeah, it's just kind of a shame that it seems like in New York State the threshold for a stallion is a $10,000 cover. Like it just doesn't seem to support otherwise. They get up to that, and then you know, they wind up going someplace. Like I remember Dixie Brass years ago. You know, he got off to a real good start at the Stallions Park right here, actually in Millbrook, for Mr. Edwards. You know, Dennis Bryda. Was, you know, trained him, and he was standing up there, and once he started really getting rolling, he wound up at Vinery in Kentucky, standing for like 25 or 30. It just, the New York breeding program just wouldn't support him over 10. It seems like that's kind of the threshold. And on that vein, though, you talk about Roddy Valenti. This is how this game was so intertwined and connected. Years ago, Roddy bought a dinner at an event for cystic fibrosis to have dinner with me and Carmella, Jerry Bailey, and his wife Susie. And so we set the thing up. He bought the evening. We went out. We had dinner. And during the evening, he was telling me how he wanted to get into ownership. So we kind of kept in touch. And next thing you know, I introduced him to Dennis Breyer. We found a New York bred for him. Ellis Park hadn't started. They go down. They buy the horse. Bring him back. I'm working the horse, and they got a runner. I mean, they said, right, this horse can run. So he wanted to run the horse in Saratoga. And, you know, he was a neophyte. He was just starting, and he asked Dennis if he could run him. There was an open company race, like the last day. So Dennis runs him there in an open company race. He finishes second, gets beat a neck. Ran him back 2 weeks later against New York Breds. He won by 6 or 8 lengths at Belmont. And his name, he named him Gravel King, because that's Roddy's business.
Right, right.
So I rode Roddy's first winner as an owner, and then let's flash forward how many years later, my last winner as a jockey was for Roddy, and it was on a Bustin' Stones named Lots of Stones. So I rode his first winner as an owner, rode my last winner as a jockey for him.
How about that?
Pretty crazy, right?
That is. I mean, the sort of the odds. Well, if we had won that photograph, the Lloyd Dobler would have been your last winner.
It would have been, and if I wasn't so broke down, just ask Gary.
Uh.
I was in a lot of pain. I will admit that. I rode hard though, but I wasn't feeling too good.
No, got beat by a good horse too. That horse went on. That Covello went on to win. Maybe over a half a million. Covello. If I'm not mistaken, that horse was one of the first successful tappet. Like it was either a first crop of tappet or it was one of the early salvos.
Yeah, it was definitely an early crop of tappet. It might have been the second crop. And and you're right. I mean, he turned out to be okay. And you know, the crazy thing is, like, I was in pain. I was trying to, you know, will my way through it. And that was Saturday. Monday, I'm in Mount Sinai in Manhattan. You know how shocked I was when he said I had six broken vertebrae?
Yeah.
I knew I was in pain, but Carmelo started crying. I'm sitting there like, no, it can't be, you know, and he's like, yeah. So then I tried to talk him into letting me go ride Life at 10 because I had just won the Affection the Honor. She was running in the 60 sales next Saturday. So I said, Doc, listen, I've been riding. I mean, I'm in a lot of pain, but I'll just go ride this filly. She's easy to ride. I'll put her on the lead. She'll win, and then I'll come back, and you can do the surgery. And he's like, you're not leaving here today. This is going to be like a light switch. Your body's telling you that you know, that's what the pain is telling you, that you can't continue to do this. I didn't get to ride Life at 10.
Well, that sounds like what I, my experience with my eye when the guy said to me, it looks like you got a detached retina and a couple of, these holes. I said, so you're gonna need surgery. I said, can it wait till Labor Day? He said, Labor Day? we're trying to get you into Albany Med tonight.
Wow.
What are you talking about?
Champions play hurt. I'm sorry, I don't care. Champions play hurt. That's it.
Exactly. Horse players, you know. What's a little blindness?
After Saratoga, we'll schedule it for after.
That's what I was trying to do.
Oh, my gosh.
Laughed at me. You're nuts. No, you're doing this now or tomorrow morning.
Well, but you know, thankfully you did it. You got through it, and you're in good shape, right? So
there you go. Me and you too. Speaking of which, weren't you going to have a follow-up, some follow-up work done, or has that been? Have things been maintained? No. Okay,
we're managing stuff. America's Day of Traces is almost over for the season.
How's that possible? Yeah. I thought, oh no, they're going to announce. Actually, you're going to start doing simulcasts with Hawthorne and with Turf Paradise, and they're going to be, the shows are going to expand. Rich, they're going to start at 11:30 now, and they're going to go until 9 o'clock at night. So prepare for.
I tell you what, the other day, me and Greg were on the late shift. I guess it was Friday.
Yes,
and it gets dark so early, and it's dark behind us because we're in the Equestris. They set up a nice little set there so we're not freezing. And we looked at each other. It felt like it was 10 o'clock at night. I mean, it was, you know, it's just crazy. And I was like, let's walk out to the car together because there ain't nobody around. But, you know what? It's been fun to do, though. And I really enjoy the people I'm working with. And the unsung heroes are all the people behind the scenes. I mean, they're just an amazing crew of people that make, you know, us look good. And they really are the ones that deserve all the credit. Everybody in the video trucks, everybody editing, everybody, you know, producing, directing, they're phenomenal and they're tireless because, you know, I might get there at 10:30 in the morning. They've been there a few hours already. If I'm leaving at 6 o'clock at night, some of them are not leaving till 7:38. I mean, they are incredible.
Well, come on, we all know the unsung hero is Andy.
Well, he's one of the heroes, but I won't say unsung.
No, the shows are, and particularly, you know, I last week I latched right on to the cross-country pick five scenario where there's going to be one every day. And so, you know, covering the Churchill races and basically being, you know, being able to latch on and watch the sequence is a lot of fun. I mean, it you know, it just sort of spills out in front of you.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, it does keep things going. I mean, there's not a lot of lull time. But you know how many features and different things they have in the can?
Sure.
If we do, you know, have one track rolling, I mean, they really, and it's been all year. I mean, I could see, like, the other night we were leaving, it was late, we were on until 6:30, and, you could see the little, you know, people a little worn out, but, again, I really appreciate them so much, and I try to make it a point on my way out to go through those offices and thank them, because honestly, we the shows wouldn't be half of what they are without them.
Well, a couple of things. Let's dive into some conversation, and I might as well follow up some of the conversation from last week before we get into some of the results from the other day. And there were two things that sort of happened after we spoke. One was when it came to the crop conversation, which it seems like you and Tony, I got to bring it up every single time we visit each week. But Eddie D wrote a piece, or, you know, Art Wilson wrote it, but Eddie D had some really pointed and succinct thoughts. And I also want you to address and get your reaction to the fallout from the Classic and the, you know, the fanfare associated with firing Manny Franco.
Well, let's talk about Eddie D first. I think he hit it out of the park with that piece. And basically he said, you know, a lot of what I was feeling, and maybe wasn't even quite articulating well enough, that you really got to, I think, play to your customers and the people that are supporting your game, and less, you know, placating people that just want to do away with racing. And he said it so well that, you know, you get people gambling on these races, on these horses. We have taken great strides, great painstaking strides to make sure that, you know, the crop is so much more humane. It's nothing like what we used at one time, and that wasn't right, and we kept modifying, and, you know, and we go back to the basics of riding. I talk about it constantly, where a jockey gives up his leg aid to be more aerodynamic and, frankly, make it easier for the horse to carry the weight running at a high speed, to have the center of gravity over the withers. And, you know, people have said things like, well, they should then ride with longer stirrups. Well, that'll lead to more injuries, because you can't hold your leg still going fast, and you're going to be shifting weight and throwing weight around on a horse that it's just going to throw them off balance and have them stepping wrong or putting too much weight on one leg at a time. So anybody who thinks that's safer is actually not really looking at it appropriately. But Eddie D was spot on. And you know, let's worry about the people that are supporting our industry, and that's the bettors, the fans, and the people that kind of know the game, you know, behind the scenes as well, horsemen and jockeys. And let's quit playing to what they think people want to see. I just think it's a mistake. And anybody who didn't see it, they have to read it to get the full impact of what I'm trying to say. He really articulated it extremely well, I believe. Don't you, Steve?
Yeah, and Tony also addressed it on Thursday, and you know, he talked about how you know, how much of Eddie, the way Eddie framed it, about, you know, rider education and rider development, and you know, Eddie bringing in the, as you just did, bringing in the horse player to it is, you know, such a welcome perspective. I mean, plenty of riders have been addressing this, and you know, the guild, whether it's Terry Meeks or Johnny, but specifically talking about the horse player and how unfair this is, you know, to have this discussion and have, you know, this thing directed and more or less dictated to the riders and to the sport by outside influence and by, you know, agencies and regulators that have no practical appreciation. And I haven't heard one comment from the regulation side, you know, saying we have to appreciate the horse players in this. Eddie bringing this in is really welcome, and that I thought was even an added benefit to, you know, some of what he told Art Wilson.
Well, Eddie, besides being one of the greatest riders of all time, is as down to earth and practical a person as you're ever going to know. And he sees it very clearly and matter-of-factly. There's not a lot of, you know, drama about it. This is what's right and this is what's wrong. And basically the statement is, too, that just what you said, how do you not bring the people it most directly affects more into the conversation or into the conversation at all, whether it be the riders who are riding the horses, the horsemen that are training the horses, the horse players who are betting on the horses? How did that their voice, all these voices, get lost in this conversation? You know, I love reading stuff by people that have never, well, you know, maybe they rode horses, but I go back to, just because I can drive on, you know, the highway doesn't mean I can drive in the Indy 500. So even if you rode, it's a whole different experience. But, you know, I keep reading stuff by people that are saying it has to be done away with, and their reasoning behind it for public perception and what have you, that really have no practical experience with it. And it's almost laughable how indignant they get what is right and what is wrong when they don't understand all the repercussions of what they're trying to do.
Right. Well, that's been a problem. That's a problem in a lot of ways, in a lot of areas of the game. I mean, and we all appreciate that there's, you know, this wide array of interests involved. But it gets exasperating when in many areas when you've got, you know, people handing down.
Well, I'll tell you how frustrating it is for me. You know, I'll listen. There will be a part of me that I'll always miss riding, and even the ability just to ride for fun, right? But and someone asked me the other day about it. Like, do you still miss it? I said, yeah, it's just like your first love. You're always going to have fond memories, right? You can't purge yourself of that. But reading all of this and seeing what's going on, it's almost the first time where I go, you know what? I'm kind of almost glad I don't do it anymore, because It as frustrating as for me to see it, if I was actually still riding, I know that it would be even twice as hard to take.
Well, this continues to be a, you know, hot topic essentially, and don't know. I don't know if there's going to be any stopping. You know, where it ends up essentially. It seems like it's got the, you know, the sort of momentum that
Well, let me ask you a question, Steve. Who's going to be culpable when something really bad happens because a guy couldn't get a horse's attention and you know, somebody gets seriously injured or worse? And horses get seriously injured or worse. So who takes the responsibility then?
No, that's what Tony did. That was one of the first things that Tony brought up that topic, and he, you know, he had examples. I mean, he had incident examples, and that's a germane question. You know, a lot of it gets back to how unusual and unique and just unlike anything else the sport and industry is.
As deafening as the sounds are now to do away with it, there'll be crickets then, I can promise you.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Let's shift to the other rip from today's headlines, which was a you know, a press release and a big fanfare to essentially blame Manny Franco for Tis the Law not impacting the Classic last week.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of things wrong with the whole situation, and let's start though. I mean, riders get taken off horses all the time. It's sure. Part of the game. You know that as a rider. And the flip side of it is riders take off horses to ride horses they think are better, or, you know, for outfits they think are better all the time. So it's part of the game, and we understand that. I guess the problem that I see with this situation is, one, I think it's disappointing to make it that public. I think it could have just been handled a little more finesse. You know, sit down with Manny privately, talk about it. If you're going to make a change, you make a change. But kind of making it, you know, headline news, to me, that's hurtful to a young rider. It throws him in a light like he's less than, that he made some egregious errors. And that could have an impact on his career in a negative way. And I think, you know, you shouldn't do that to people. This is how he makes his living. And I really feel like putting him on the center stage as the scapegoat is just poor form. And you know, I rode Funny Side for Jack Knowlton and Barkley. I have the utmost respect for Barkley as a horseman. I'm friendly with Jack, but I just think it was handled poorly. That's the first thing being said. Do you think, I don't believe that Manny rode the horse great in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I don't think he rode him well in the Holy Bull when he won it. But why? So that's what you have to start dissecting. Manny Franco's not a kid that's looking to get outside all the time. He's very, very brave. He's very, very strong. He doesn't bail out of spots. He gets his, you know, he gets his position going forward. You watch him ride on a day-in, day-out basis. We could go through, you know, 500 races. Handful of times I saw him ride out of character and ride a horse poorly was Tis the Law, and that was because you could see he had to get outside. And from everything I've read, and I don't know this firsthand, so maybe I'm not being 100% fair, but everything I read, they have kind of driven the narrative that this horse does not run well inside. And I don't see that at all. I don't see a horse that's tentative. I don't see a horse that's off the bridle. I see a horse that's in the bridle and pulling up on heels. Horses that are intimidated inside do not do that, Steve. They don't. That's a fact. So just because they've got it stuck in their head, he has to be outside to make his run, I just believe is false. It's a mistake to think that way. Plus, you have to be so much the best to constantly get to that outside position and still think you're good enough to win. So the mistake Manny made in the Classic was, all right, they folded over. Maybe he should have gone on more, but again, I don't know the instructions. They say, well, we don't want you on the lead. He always breaks on top. Why wouldn't you just let him alone and let him be where he's going to be? You know, think about the way Johnny Velasquez rode Gamine. And he rode her and rode her and rode her until Serengeti Empress finally cleared him, and now he's laying second in the clear. But if he had just put her in his hands, he would have had horses fold over. He'd have been stuck in the pocket. So, yeah, sometimes you have to make more use of a horse, but it just feels like watching Manny ride and knowing him ride Tis the Law and knowing how he rides on a daily basis, and I watch on a daily basis, he's handcuffed. He's overcoached. He's always thinking, I got to get out to the right in the clear instead of, okay, now they fold it over. I'm in behind Authentic. He's live. He's going to carry me a long way. Sometimes he has a tendency to drift. I'm going to stay right here and behind him and keep following him. And instead of going forward and following his wake, he's going to the right, and he's taking back to get outside. You know, the ground he gave up doing that was pretty much the ground he couldn't make up in the stretch. And, you know, I interviewed Johnny Velasquez last week, and he was great and very candid, and we talked about it. We actually aired, it has to be edited down. We talked for almost 20 minutes, but we aired 5 minutes of it on the America's Day at the Races show, and nobody was beating Authentic that day. He said, Richie, every time somebody got close to me, he jumped back in the bridle. Even on the gallop, I kept jumping back in the bridle. But a jockey's job is to give their horse the best chance to win, and Manny took that away by going to the right. But I believe it's because, what do they say, too many chefs spoil the soup. Everybody needs to stay in their lane. Barkley gets the horse ready. He's a tremendous horse trainer. I believe Hall of Fame worthy. Turn the keys over to the car and let Manny do his job. You're in the paddock, an owner telling you, oh, you got to be outside or you got to be. Do you remember years ago that Gary Stevens riding Point Given on the way to the gate in Haskell, and Bob Baffert said, like on the NBC feed or ABC, whatever it was, tell Gary, make sure he's, because he was talking to the outrider, make sure he keeps it stick in his left hand. And Gary blew up at him. You don't need somebody in your head when you're getting ready to break out of the gate. You know what you have to do. You're in a zone. You're focused. You can't ride to please everybody. As a jockey, you've got to be able to react. And I believe they inhibited Manny Franco's ability to react and ride the way he would want to and the way it was naturally. Tom Brady wouldn't go to the line of scrimmage and see blitz and not feel like he can call an audible, right? I mean, And the thing is, he'll find now, like this experience, he'll, from now on, I guarantee you, he'll go, okay, that's what they want me to do, but I'm going to do what's right because I got fired doing what everybody else wants me to do. And I can't tell you how many times I rode a horse, Steve, and listened implicitly to the instructions given me and got beat and got fired. And I can't tell you how many times I completely disregarded instructions and did what I thought was right and won the race and was told, what a great ride. And that's the nature of our business. But I just feel like they set Manny up to fail. And it's disappointing. And it's so important right now for Manny to win races for himself. Because the way this went down and as publicly as it was addressed and kind of throwing him to the wolves, could really, really affect the kid's psyche, his confidence, and hurt his career. And that's the last thing you want to see happen. I think he's strong enough. He's tough enough. I think he's got enough support behind him that he'll be fine. But I was so happy. Like, when he won on Eagle Orb, the stake on Saturday, He really celebrated. Like, that was the classic. And I think that speaks to the emotion of, like, the position he's been cast into. And it's really unfair.
No, well put, and really, kind of looks at it from all the various angles. I made reference to it last week too, Rich. I mean, for the people that aren't familiar with the backstory, I mean, Authentic and we're not Authentic, but 'Tis the Law was the linchpin. Crowbar that ultimately ended Johnny and Angel's association, and there's some rather odd confluences that find him ultimately getting on the horse, now as they target Pegasus.
Well, it's interesting because in the interview I asked Johnny about that, and I think there's been a lot of innuendo about what went down, and I think there's a few things, and what I gleaned from it was it wasn't exactly that maybe that had some contributing factors to it, but and this is what I gleaned from the conversation, the interview, was that Johnny's at a stage of his career where he doesn't want to ride 9-10 races a day, and honestly, your body takes a beating over the years physically. It's hard to get up for that many races a day when you hit a certain age. Johnny's older than I am, older than I was when I retired now. And I know what a struggle it was at that point and how, to ride a full card. And then mentally, to be able to have, do the preparation. And Angel was always a rider that wanted to ride. It did not matter. Angel would ride 9 or 10 at Belmont or Aqueduct and then head over the Meadowlands and ride another 7, 8, 9, 10. That's him. That's his personality. I think it was hard for Angel to adjust to the fact that Johnny needed to be handled a little differently, managed a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think Johnny could ever quite get it through to Angel, like, I'm fine riding 3 or 4 a day, 5 a day on weekends, you know, better race days, fine, but not, you know, and Angel as a rider hardly turned down a mount ever and probably found it very hard as an agent to turn down mounts, thinking, well, I'd like to ride him. I mean, I was cutting more from Angel's cloth, but that was also that era. You know, my first race, there was like 12-horse field, 8 or 9 Hall of Famers riding a maiden 25 that last race at Belmont. You know, Lafitte Pink Eye, Angel Cordero, George Velasquez. I mean, that was the year the guys rode. You know, but also the purses were a lot different. So maybe, different hunger factor involved there. But, you know, you look at the guys who have been able to maintain and ride into their later years. Jerry Bailey, the end of his career, Jerry was very well managed. You know, he wasn't going to ride every race, but he was great. Mike Smith, still, you know, managing it. I'm probably leaving people out, but I think Johnny was looking at that going, I kind of need to be handled like that now. And I just, it feels like, and this is my speculation and from everything I've gleaned from it, that Angel just couldn't adjust to having to manage Johnny differently. You know, it's one thing to have Johnny Velasquez at 20 and another thing to have him at, you know, 45, right? It's just different. And again, Angel was always 100 miles an hour straight ahead. He wasn't, you know, guy came to him with a 7,500 claimer. Yeah, let's do it. You know, so it's hard for him to adjust to that. That's what it feels like to me.
Well, and no one is going to argue that this hasn't, you know, that the way things have unfolded hasn't been good, I mean, for Johnny, frankly. And, you know, with Ron Anderson, who also actually handled, you know, Jerry Bailey through what essentially was the second half of his career and very successfully, it's a... You know, it's a good scenario for everybody on that front. And Manny is going to, you know, Manny's career is going to continue on under Angel and be successful. I've talked about it with you. We've talked about it with Tony. It's the most unusual active athlete relationship in any sport environment, because you know the agent for any other athlete is really out of sight. I mean, it's not like there's a daily interaction between an agent, a sports agent, and their client. I mean, they'll negotiate contracts, which might be every 3 to 4 or 5 years, and they'll handle, you know, the other business stuff, but it's not like this. I mean, this is such an unusual volatile scenario.
I don't like the trend I see though right now. Agents are working more and more remotely. And before COVID, before all the pandemic and everything, you got a guy living in Florida but handling a guy in New York and a guy in Kentucky. And for years, there was, you know, they wouldn't allow agents to have more than one journeyman, one apprentice, and then they opened that up. And now you got guys with, you know, 2 jockeys under his name, and then I got a guy under his name, and oh, I handle another guy in Kentucky. It's gotten out of hand, and everything that was feared about opening it up and letting a guy have 2, now they've just run roughshod over it, and I don't like the trend. I think the jockey agent jockey relationship was much more intimate, close-knit. I used to love to get done riding. I'd walk out, talk about every horse I rode that day with my agent, you know, and who you really wanted to ride back, or hey, if he would drop that horse a little, if he'd stretch him out, and you'd have this, you know, repartee about it, and then your agent would go back to the different trainers and say, you know, Meg really thinks this horse would be better doing this, doing that. It was better for the horses, better for the trainer, better for the rider. And now you see a lot of shenanigans going on, you know, where a guy's got, you know, several riders in several locales. And I don't care for it. I don't think it's the way it was meant to be. It, you know, a lot of guys that are probably good agents aren't going to get a shot because the guy's got five or six riders tied up with riders under other people's names, and he's taking half the money. It's too much collusion, too much monopoly, and it's so evident. I mean, it's embarrassingly obvious what's going on. And, you know, I wish, you want to talk about regulation, let the regulators step in and stop that nonsense. Because that's something that I actually really think affects the game in a negative way, knowing where, you know, everybody's going with their horse. Well, you don't want to run in that spot because so-and-so's running a killer in there, and it hurts the racing office, and they're going to kill races. If that's not, like, insider information, I don't know what is. So I, sorry about that rant, but I believe that, you know, wholeheartedly. And on the end of two, like, you know, Ron had me for, you know, several months in California, and it was just an amazing, pleasurable experience, just as professional as could be, and you know, really managed me. I'll go down rabbit hole, Steve, with like looking at horses, and then go on Equibase and click on a race that I want on that day on that particular horse, and then I'll go through the whole card, and just you start kind of exploring, and I can't tell you. And I was a guy who pulled weight every single day. There wasn't a day in my career that I wasn't pulling 3, 4, 5 pounds every single day. And it was hard on me. I wasn't built to be a jockey. How many days I'd ride the entire card? And you, okay, if you ride the card, but they're for, like, people you ride for. I'm looking at, okay, this horse was 5-1. Guy I ride for, this horse was 6-1. Hey, I wrote a favorite here. All right, hey, wait, I'm on this 60-1 shot. Who's this for? Oh, some guy who shipped in from Rockingham. My agent needed to ride that horse. I can't tell you how many horses I rode that were 30, 40, 50-1 for people that weren't clients, were shipping in from someplace, or, you know, people that I didn't ride for. Regularly. Why wouldn't an agent go, man, I got a guy who comes out, and I've worked horses every morning, comes out, works 5-6 horses at least every morning, and then he goes off to the jock's room at 10 o'clock. He spends 2.5 hours pulling weight in a plastic suit, rubbed with salt in a 150-degree sauna, skipping rope, and then put him on 10 and 9. Why? And it actually bothers me more now, because when I was doing it, I just, hey, I ride. I keep going. It would have been, you know, people have this image of me of being such a kind of a mean guy. Yeah, I was mean. I never got a break. The only time I got a break is when I broke something.
Well, and not to mention, you know, part of that, you know, sort of edgy anger is also hunger. You know, your body's eating itself alive because you're not.
You're living 700 calories a day. If you overeat, you got to go flip it. You got to throw it up. If you, you know, you drink too much water, and literally, like, that's at the point I was at. Well, okay, I got to get in the hot box and pull this water out of my system. And then you get an agent that, you know, is hitting Smith and Walensky's at night, telling you, oh yeah, well, you got to ride those horses for that guy. Really? Why?
He's over at Peter Luger down in a 44 ounce porterhouse.
I mean, you know, and listen, you know, it's just funny because I was the other night. I stayed downstate. I was in the hotel room. I couldn't sleep. I started going through charts and looking at stuff. I'm telling you, I rode almost every single race, every single day, an entire Saratoga meet. If you saw some of the horses I rode, you'd go, what were you doing on that horse? I mean, and again, when I was in the midst of it, I just kept doing it. But you know how much easier it would have been for me to, you know, have a couple races off and save those calories, you know, have a little bit, be a little more clear thinking. I mean, I think back to some of the things I said to some trainers after races. I mean, I must have been out of my mind. I mean, I really was not quite right.
Well, something tells me we need to get Drew Mollica on the phone, because he's obviously responsible for this.
No, I'm not. I'm actually had a different agent in mind. I think Drew actually recognized that in me, but he was an agent, couldn't always help himself. But no, I actually had somebody else more specific in mind. No, Drew was a terrific agent. You know, I was hard on Drew because I was hard on myself. And I don't think he always understood that. Like, you know, I never was harder on an agent than I was on myself, and I was hard on agents. You know, I just had a different mindset. I couldn't – I think I told you the story once. I won four at Aqueduct one day. I think I won the Bed of Roses, rode good all day. Last race of the day, I'm on a horse, sitting on the fence, got a ton of horse underneath me. And jockey 101, don't try to go up inside of a tiring horse at, like, at the 3/8 pole when he's got stronger horses outside of him, because they're going to see you and they're going to put pressure on him, and he can't control – you know, where he gets moved when he's out of horse. And I think I was anticipating winning my fifth race of the day, and I kind of went to kick up in there, and it was actually Angel was outside the horse, and he saw me and shoved him over. I hit the fence, nearly got dropped, backed out, came outside, came flying, and missed. You know, got beat ahead. So if I was just patient, I'm going to win, right? I got in the car, drove home, and I'm sick. Like, the four I won meant nothing. The one I got beat that I should have won is consuming me. And I walk in the house, and Carmel's like, oh, good day. You won the stake. You won four. And I was miserable. That was a horrible day. I rode like crap. I couldn't put it away. I cououldn't. And that night, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm still watching race tapes downstairs in my den. She comes down from the bed. She's like, what are you doing? And I said, you see what I did? I'm exposed. I'm not a good rider. Everybody sees I'm not a good rider. And she's like, you've got to address this. You need help. And I went to a sports psychologist because of her to handle that. You know, you're never as good as you think you are, and you're never as bad as the one you messed up. You're human. But I couldn't hack that. I couldn't get it through my head. But that's how consumed I was with trying to be the best I can be. And for somebody not being naturally built to be a rider, there was so much other pressure on top of that that it really was unhealthy. And thankfully, she got me to kind of look at it different, and I got help, and it got better. And I was in a much better place the last part of my career than, you know, actually when I was having the most success, when I was in my prime.
Yeah, and that you know, the boy, there's a million follow-ups I could spin to that, you know, which includes, you know, you had you've had a couple of cups of coffee representing, and you know, you certainly, obviously, with your brother representing Dylan Davis, you know, you see, you know, the firsthand. It's a position, you know, a job, quote unquote, that requires a certain, you know, deftness. I mean, being an agent, and I don't know if everybody is equipped to, you know, to be, you know, a psychologist, essentially, and to, you know, say the kinds of things necessary to smooth over those kinds of issues with riders. And you know, and I suppose if a younger rider, it's probably easier than somebody that, you know, is a little further along in their career. But, you know, that part of it, you know, that's one element that, you know, you might be terrific looking at the condition book and knowing who the horses are on the backstretch and matching up your rider to the right horses. But there's also that degree of being able to be, you know, a camp counselor and you know, and the school psychologist too.
Yeah. I, the one thing that I try to impart this to all young riders, like, for every athlete, there is a last day. For every baseball player, there's a last at bat. You know, there. For every jockey, there's a last ride, and you pray for every rider that their last ride is by their choosing. That they make that conscious decision that I've done enough, I've had enough. Very few get that opportunity. Jerry Bailey, Pat Day, Chris McCarron come to mind. They had amazing, tremendous careers, tremendous accomplishments, and they had their fill, and they were able to step back and you know, start the second part of their life, or the next chapter, if you will. But most riders don't get that opportunity. And I think a rider owes it to themselves to make the most out of whatever abilities God gave them and to hone those abilities and make themselves the best they can be. And the way I've explained it is because there's a day that you can't do that anymore. And do you want to look back on it and go, gosh, I could have done better, or I should have done more, or because you don't have a do-over at that point. It's over. And you're in a job where an ambulance follows you around. Don't you think you owe it to yourself to be the best you can be? I mean, it's dangerous. So if you're going to go out there and do it to the best of your capabilities. Don't just, it's one thing to be a jockey. It's another thing to be a race rider. A race rider is a guy who really works on the art of race riding. He really, it's a way of life. It's not a job. It's a lifestyle. It's, you know, how you eat, how you sleep, how you think, your approach. And it's frustrating to me when I see young, talented guys that don't quite understand that, because you hope they understand it before that day when it is the last ride. Because, again, you have no do-overs. You can't go, you know what, I'll do it this way. It's done. It's done. You can't go back.
Rich Migliori with us. And, Rich, we've got about 8 or 9 minutes to the top of the hour. Might as well finish out the hour. Eric Hallstrom is going to join us from Indiana in a little bit. But I do want to – one thing I did want to do, because I promised it to somebody on Twitter, and since we're talking, you know, jocks in general, let me get an early read on Aqueduct. Well, I'll talk with Andy tomorrow about some specific races, but I'd love for you to give us your first couple of weekend views of some of the new faces in the room. And it feels like before guys head to Florida, that it's a newly competitive landscape going on at Aqueduct right now. The racing, you know, these first 2 weeks, and already the cards for Thursday and Friday are terrific. You got almost nothing but full fields. Talk about some of the new faces. I love that Nick Juarez is on hand. I like the way he rides. There's real interest in Farron Peterson and her, carrying her momentum, and Julie Crone, carrying their momentum in from Monmouth. And then, of course, there's the matter of Julie Crone once again roaming the backstretch at Belmont, which is, a story unto itself. Gary called me the other morning and said, look who's here. And it's like, it's just fun and funny to have her, marauding into tack rooms again in New York. Carlos Marquez, talk about some of the new faces.
Yeah, well, you know what? It was good to see Charlie Marquez get a win yesterday, because he had that injury about 6 weeks ago, and he was just kind of starting to gain some momentum, so I was really happy for him. And delivered a terrific ride on Vitesse for Michelle Nevin. That kid's very professional for an apprentice. He's very, very polished. I love this because it reminds me of, back in the day when the inner track was still fairly new. Winter racing was, I won't say a novelty, but it was only like 4 or 5 years into its fruition that you'd get this influx of guys trying to come here, and most notably, Steve Cawthon, coming for that first winter here, and when he took New York by storm with Lenny Goodman. And, the year I had the bug, we started out like 12 new apprentices, starting in New York, from Jack Cannell, Ricky Frazier, Alan McChesney, Mike McMullen, Danny Fuller. I mean, there was literally like 12 apprentices starting out that winter. And everybody's just trying to get that foothold, get your foot in the door and, establish yourself while other, more high-profile riders go to Florida or California. Years ago, they used to split up. A lot of the guys would go to California. And I remember that first winter, like I was probably like 8th or 10th on the list of people's expectations to make. It was kind of gawky and tall, and then I wound up sticking, and slowly everybody, other guys start falling away, and I wound up hanging in there. But it has that feel this year. Like all these guys coming in, and Harry Hernandez, my brother Michael, took his book as well. He won a race the other day for Dave Donk, gave a real good ride.
I like Harry Hernandez, and I'm glad he's back for the winter. He won for us on Corey Bant, and or not Corey Bant, on somebody else. And I think he's terrific. Spends the season up at Finger Lakes.
Yeah, no, I think he's making a nice impression. They're getting good response. I actually said to Farron Peterson the other day, don't get discouraged, because here's the difference this year, though. Because of the pandemic, you're a new rider in a new place, and your strength was getting out there in the morning and working horses for people and the enthusiasm, bouncing barn to barn, and people getting to know you, getting to know your personality a little bit, getting, some insight into who you are as a person as well as a rider. And then I've always said, being a jockey, working horses in the morning, it's like an actor auditioning for parts. You get to get on horses and the guy's just not going to think you're a good fit, so you didn't get that part. Doesn't mean that you're not going to work more horses for the guy, and then you're going to get some other horse that he thinks you fit. That's, the role he thinks you're stronger at. So these guys, and like Farron, sounds like in Monmouth, she worked a ton of horses, and people got to know her, and she really had a great meet. So they're at a little bit of a disadvantage not being able to do that because of the pandemic. You can work horses, but they got to bring them to the paddock for you, or wherever it's designated now to go out and work horses. So it's different than going barn to barn, kind of beating the pavement and getting around. But I like what I see. I think we've got a good group of riders and a good group of hungry riders, because they want to establish themselves. They want to make it. They want to prove that they belong in the big leagues. And let's be honest, New York is the big leagues. You're going to ride at Aqueduct, Belmont, Saratoga. This is the major leagues, just like Santa Anita, just like the championship meet at Gulfstream. These are the major leagues, and not to disparage any other racing circuits, but there are certain circuits that you have to be an elite rider to be competitive on a consistent basis. So you got talented young people in here, and the ones that'll stick it out and work hard and show they can do it, they'll make it. We see it every year, but this year more than I can remember in a lot of years, just a lot of young talent. I thought Trevor McCarthy might try it. He's got a good thing going on down in Laurel, but he came up and rode the first weekend with Breeders' Cup, and he certainly belongs in that category.
No, no doubt. And there's a bunch more I didn't even mention. You've got Heman Harkey that fights for mounts. We should
nice
mention Sebastian Saez coming to town.
Well, Sebastian Saez has always shown a great deal of ability. He just needs to mature a bit. From what I see right now, I'm seeing signs that he has matured a great deal. He's been his own worst enemy. If he can keep his attitude right and do all the right things, he can do anything he wants. He's very talented. He rides a great deal like his brother Louis. Louis just, grew up a little faster, if you will. And I don't mean that as a knock. Everybody, matures at their own pace. But, if you want to make it in New York, you got to handle yourself and conduct yourself in a certain way.
How about Castro Rodriguez? What do you make of him?
Yeah, no, like what I see. Good finisher. It's funny. I haven't been able to really study as much as I want the riders. I was split up like Breeders' Cup weekend. I was reporting the first 3 days, and then just the last few days I was on the desk. But I think we've got a bunch of kids that can really ride. And there's always adjustments, too. New York's a little different than some other places of how you're going to ride and you got to be careful. I see one thing I see that's a trend. Don't play follow the leader. Like, just because a guy's a high-profile rider, if he jumps out to the lead, don't be afraid to take him on. Don't like, if he slows it down too much, go grab him by the throat latch. Let him know that he can't just, you know, run the race the way he wants to run it. You know, you're out there competing. I see that a little bit. I've seen it in the past, too, where, you know, big name rider goes to the lead and another kid's kind of wrestling off of him because, well, that's, you know, Angel Cordero or that's George Velasquez. I don't want to, you know, get them mad at me or something. No, you want them mad at you. That means you're a threat. You know, you want to be a thorn in their side. So that's the one thing I hope that, you know, most of these kids avoid. And as it weeds out a little bit, they'll find their voice, if you will.
Well, you don't have to worry about Rich finding his voice. Absolutely fabulous. And two for the price of one today, Rich. We got an hour. We got two segments in, and I was only expecting one. But you were too good. I wasn't going to pull you up.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, I love talking horses with you.
Exactly. With anybody, it's, you know, that's what's made you so popular. And you know, when you have we see it at Saratoga, you know, or downstate, when, you know, when people come and talk to you, and everybody's got that's how I first met you. When I came up to you, and you had done I was working the barbecue, and you had done Mary Ryan's show.
Okay, I don't remember this. I'm sorry, but
you had done Mary Ryan in the Carousel. You know, Mary's little talk show, and I thought, I said, you know what, I got to go introduce myself to Rich, and I went up because I told you the story of my. You know, that you were always one of my favorites, and you and Stevens, and my big betting, you know, my first IRS ticket, and you know, told the whole story, you know, keynote speaker and Balinar, and you remember.
Right, Chavez rode the other horse. Yeah.
Exactly. And you remembered it. And you said, listen, I got to run, but, you know, I'll talk to you again. And little did you, you know, little did I know, and little did you know that we'd have these, you know, we'd have these conversations the last 15 years.
Well, you know what? I'm very glad we do.
Exactly, as am I. Rich Migliori, everybody. Richard Migliori, what's the plan? Are you hiking today? What are you doing?
Yeah, I got all my barn work done before I did the call with you. I'm going hiking for a while, not a real long one today, because I want to go to the market and see if they got the boneless short ribs. I want to do braised short ribs tonight.
Get out of here. And I got 2 pounds of short ribs I'm making stew with later.
Oh, you know, you see great minds think alike. I mean, it's like the perfect weather for it, so I'm going to do that. And I'm on 5 days this week. I'm actually on Wednesday through Sunday. I'm doing the Parks Churchill card on Wednesday at Aqueduct.
Oh, the big Parks Churchill card. Fantastic. Well, looking forward to it. And we'll exchange pictures of your short ribs versus my beef stew with short rib. But I'll tell you what, we went down to Troy to the farmer's market on Saturday, which is great. And I
really?
Got,
I've never
oh,
been
it's great.
There.
Oh, it's fabulous. It's tremendous. There must be 60, 70 vendors. And there's a husband and wife right over in Arlington, which is not far from here, Arlington, Vermont, on the border.
Okay.
And when you head out toward Cambridge, along the Battenkill, and the first town you come to in Vermont is Arlington. And I've seen for years this little sign, the Vermont Spetzel Company. And I've said to Tina 100 times, we should stop there and get some Spetzel, which I love. You know, the little German noodle dumpling.
Right,
like a chewy dumpling. And it just so happens that this guy is at the Troy market. And so I got a 2 pound bag of Spetzel, and I'm gonna do the beef stew with Spetzel on the side with maybe a little sauerkraut or onions. So don't know yet. Probably onions. Probably some.
You know. You know what? Maybe I won't cook. Maybe I just get in the car and come by you.
Exactly. Well, we owe each other a home and home dining experience too. So put that on the list.
Sounds good. Steve, you have a great day.
This was tremendous. Rich Migliori, everybody. Follow Rich. Richard Migliori. Use both names. And we've really had fun with Rich joining the Monday lineup. It's been just a great addition. We'll take a timeout a little past the top of the hour. And my man Nick Hahn down in Virginia. His 91-year-old mother still making spetzel by hand. I love it. Nick, you've got a 91-year-old mother. I've got a 91-year-old father. Look at that. There was something else I was going to do. I'm so easily distracted. speaking of the food, of our food predilections, it is the week before Thanksgiving. And I do promise we will have our visit with Neil Kleinberg, and we'll talk about how to approach this and you know, keeping the size of the gatherings down just makes obvious sense under the circumstances. But how do you adjust? You know, how do you got to adjust? You know, you, if you're used to making food for 12 to 16, how do you make food for, you know, for 6 to 8? So, Neil Kleinberg from Clinton Street Baking Company later in the week for his annual, now annual, Thanksgiving instructions. Back after this, we're into hour 3. The morning is flown by, and we're going to get Eric Hallstrom in here from Indiana. Later today, they're going to start their final week. It's been a absolutely magical season at Indiana. Phenomenal. And we'll celebrate it a little with Eric Hallstrom next. At the Races, Hour 3 here on SiriusXM.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on SiriusXM Radio.
Don't miss a second of thrilling live racing from Aqueduct this fall on America's Day at the Races on Fox Sports. Watch Maggie Wolfendale, Andy Serling, and the entire All-Star cast bring you the best of fall racing live from Aqueduct. For full TV listings, visit NYRA.com.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
From BRL Equine, the people that bring you EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Shield, now comes Flexify HA, the most advanced scientifically based joint supplement on the market. To find out more, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880. To be the best, give them only the best. BRL Equine.